From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Robert Ludlum. He writes best-selling international thrillers like The Bourne Identity and The Parsifal Mosaic. See if you can recognize his voice from the commercials he used to do. Also today, I speak with jazz singer Cassandra Wilson. With her new album, Days Away, Wilson's building on her reputation as one of the best new female vocalists around. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Now and Zen, the new album from Robert Plant, the former lead singer for the rock group Led Zeppelin. And film critic Stephen Schiff remembers Divine, the late character actor who turned his 300-pound body into a fashion statement when he starred in the movies of John Waters. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Espionage, conspiracies, terrorists, and secret governments are the stuff of Robert Ludlum's international thrillers. Ludlum likes to keep his readers in suspense. Book critic John Leonard once wrote, "Ludlum tells his story like a man who must get it done before the house burns down around us. I sprained my wrists turning his pages." Most of Ludlum's books make it onto the bestseller lists. Some of his best-known novels are The Bourne Identity, The Parsifal Mosaic, and The Holcroft Covenant. Ludlum's book, The Osterman Weekend, was made into a film directed by Sam Peckinpah. Robert Ludlum's new book, The Icarus Agenda, is set in the Middle East and in Washington, D.C. A group of Arab terrorists seize the American embassy, and an American congressman attempts to infiltrate the terrorists by posing as one himself. I spoke with Robert Ludlum from the NPR Bureau in New York, and I asked him if the story of The Icarus Agenda was inspired by real events.
No, not really. Contrary to what a lot of people think, and especially since my name was used so frequently during the Iran scam hearings, I believe Senator Rudman stood in the Capitol steps and said, "If Robert Ludlum had written this, I'd believe it, but not as fact." But I can assure you, no, it is not based on any particular event, and I finished the novel before the Iran scam hearings. I just wanted to get that out of the way, Terry, okay?
Good enough. Well, speaking of the Iran-Contra hearings, though, did that make you think that truth is stranger than fiction?
No, it just sort of convinced me that my paranoia was not exactly, unrequited, as it were.
Well, you've been writing about secret governments for some time.
Yes, I have. I think one of my themes is the abuse of power, both elected and appointed.
There are secret governments. There are also, like, individual fanatics that you write about.
Yeah.
Do you think
that
kind of fanaticism and those kinds of secret governments don't choose sides, that they are to be found in all in all political sides throughout the world?
Well, I think there's always a fringe, a lunatic fringe, on anything that is so absolute that does not consider the other fellow's point of view. In other words, people who don't want to negotiate are going to be fanatical. It's really a kind of a, you know, either or. You're either my way or else you're not. And that's the kind of blind thinking that I find so abhorrent, and that's why I write about it, I guess.
Now, your main character in The Icarus Agenda is a fairly unassuming guy, especially at the beginning, and he's someone who doesn't want a lot of attention.
Well, he's somebody who is not ambitious in the political sense, and that's why I, I might as well tell you that the reason why this book came about was that there are two existing realities that I loathe. One is the senseless violence of the Middle East. And it doesn't matter, you know, whose imprimatur is where or what territory belongs to whom, because there are all sides to all stories. But we're all human underneath. And how can they continue, both sides, with this extraordinary animalism? That's one thing I loathe. The other thing I loathe is what I call the manipulation of the body politic. Now, I'm talking about this country because I live here. We have the best system, I think, in the world, but nevertheless, there are the corruptors. And that's another thing I don't like. We're told things are one way, and you peel the layers away, and we find out it's something else. So I thought that if I could tell the story of one man crossing from one world into another, both parts of these worlds that I find outrageous, I thought it would make a more meaningful, possibly more powerful book. I jumped ahead like this because I think I'm anticipating some of your questions.
Okay, good enough.
I didn't mean that in a pejorative sense at all.
No, you know that. There are hostages and fanatics in your book, and this might be an absurd question, but, you know, I was wondering if you actually ever called up any people who had been taken hostage to see what it felt like from their perspective?
No, but I know several who have.
Oh, you know people who have been hostages?
Yes, and
you've
spoken to them particularly about it? in this area of what I wrote about, but I know people who have been taken hostage, and I have talked with them. But mainly it's imagination. It's not hard to imagine yourself as a hostage. And, you know, if anybody's ever been in the Marine Corps, ask them.
Well, how about this? You also, I mean, there are people who get shot in your book, and you try to imagine what it would feel like. You know,
well, I was in World War II.
Were you ever shot?
No.
Do you ever wonder what it would feel like to be shot?
Well, of course, don't we all?
Yeah, I've dreamt about it many times.
No, I don't mean that. But I mean, you know, when you read about the violence that's taking place, you've got to put yourself in a victim's shoes every now and then. You can't help it. It's human nature to think, my God, what must it be like? I have been severely hurt. Yes, we all have, and the human condition can't take it. It's one of the reasons why there's no protagonist or no real character in any of my books that is severely wounded and gets up in the next chapter and chases the Indians. I mean, the human condition can't take that, and I try to explain that. I think one of the nicest things that somebody said about the violence in my books was that after you read a violent scene in one of Ludlum's books, the last thing you want to do is go out and get in a fight. And I think I thought that was a nice compliment.
Well, someone else once pointed out about your books that the main character is usually on the verge of exhaustion.
Yeah, sure, because you can't go through what I put a character through and not be exhausted. I was watching a film the other night on television, a late night film, and here was a guy running up a hill. He was doing all the Rambo nonsense you can think of, and he walks into the next scene, and he talks like he's just had a cocktail down at Larry's Bar. I mean, it's unbelievable how they... No, the human condition can't take that. When you're hurt, you're hurt. You don't recover that quickly.
Novelist Robert Ludlum is my guest, and his new thriller is called The Icarus Agenda. Now, you know, this brings to mind James Bond, and I say that because Bond was one of the early, post-World War II espionage heroes. Did you ever...
Well, that's early for you, dear. Yes. Children, my God, they're all children.
Did you read a lot of Ian Fleming before
you
started writing yourself?
I had read none of Ian Fleming, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, because his writing isn't much like yours at all.
No, I don't think so. No, I think what he does, he did superbly. Now that I've, you know, in later years, I've read much of what he did. And I read it mainly because I ran into a fellow named William Stevenson, who was known as the man called Intrepid, for whom Ian Fleming worked. And when they were forming British intelligence, those people in Canada. And that's how I began to read Ian Fleming. And I was amazed at how accurate he was in some of the things that he detailed in an almost comic fashion. And yet I knew from doing whatever minor research I was capable of that, my God, they were accurate. And then somebody pointed out to me, well, yes, he was there.
You know, one thing that always stuck in my mind about the Ian Fleming novels is that the James Bond character was always in jeopardy. He was always on the verge of being sadistically tortured.
Yes, he did. But I think there was a wonderful sort of, tongue-in-cheek attitude to the way Fleming wrote on those things, and I thought it was delightful.
Now, there's American and British traditions of espionage writing. Do you think there are any differences between the way Americans like yourself and the way the British writers like Le Carré write about the subject, the genre?
Yeah, I think there's a difference. I think that they can be more obviously cerebral than some of the American writers of the genre that I have been identified with. Cerebral in the sense of introspection. I try to show introspection without really talking about it that much. But they have their doubts, their self-doubts, are expressed more voluminously than I do. I try to do it in quick brushstrokes so that you see the pain through the introspection, because I think if somebody is that introspective, he wouldn't be in the business he's in. And that's why I do it my way.
I think the genre's changed a lot since the end of World War II.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think we've suddenly become taken a little bit more seriously, which I'm not sure is a good thing, but
Well, why not? Why not?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, why not? Yeah, surely. I'm a professional,
Do you have inside sources that you cultivate in the CIA or in government who give you interesting information?
Oh, yeah, there's Daffy Duck and Bugs Bunny. And, no, not really. I must say that several people I went to college with have ended up in Allied intelligence circles, and they still remain great friends of mine. I've never asked them, nor would they violate anything, but sometimes if I'll call them up to just say, hey, blank, what do you think about so-and-so? And if they laugh too hard, then I figure I'm getting near a target. But that's about it. I know. It's mainly imagination. You know, William Stevenson, again, intrepid, once said that the success of deep cover intelligence under severe stress, read violence, its success is determined by the use of extreme imagination under severe stress. And if you think through that, you can put yourself in those positions, or in that position, plural, that you can imagine. Your imagination will take over from there.
Now, I asked you a little bit about Le Carré and Ian Fleming. Do you read much of Tom Clancy, and I wonder what you think of his books?
No, I haven't, and I really do want to, but I have not read Mr. Clancy's work, only because I've been working. And while
Maybe it's so you wouldn't have to comment on programs like this.
No. I wouldn't. In the first place, you know, the literary vineyards, if I may use the word loosely, is such a wide one. I have no negative comments about people in my profession because I know how hard we work. If I find that there's someone whose work I don't appreciate, this is not a case in point, by the way. But if I find there's a work of a contemporary of mine that I don't really appreciate, I simply have never read him. But in this case, no, I honestly haven't. My wife has read him and finds him delightful. But I just haven't had time because last 3 or 4 years, I've been working rather hard.
Your novels are very intricately plotted. Do you arrange them elaborately on index cards or large maps before you set about actually writing the book?
Oh, no, I'm too dumb for that. No. What I do is that I will start with an outline, and it can go anywhere from 50 to 100 pages, and then with a couple of initial scenes. And then a lot of the book will depend on the development of the characters as they are developed, as I develop them. They'll have certain strengths, certain weaknesses, vulnerabilities, and that will help shape where I'm going. The complexity is deliberate. I do not think the life isn't simple. And as a result, I don't stay away from complexity for fear that I'm going to be confusing someone, because I think people are much smarter than that. I think readers don't mind complexity, and I guess they don't. I do not simplify for the sake of simplification. I think that's kind of pretentious.
I read in one place that you ran away from home at the age of 14 to join the Marines, to lie about your age and join the Marines. And another place I read that at the age of 14 you ran away to be in the theater. I'm not sure if either of those things are true.
Well,
so maybe
there's a grain of truth in all of it, but it's like today everybody says what a successful actor I was. Well, that is totally nonsense. I mean, I barely survived as an actor. But it's true. I did not run away from home. I left home. And I left home originally to go on the stage. I was in Junior Miss and Janie in the Chicago, New York companies. And it's true that I did not join the Marines then. What I did was I tried to enlist in the Royal Canadian Air Force. And I was using another name. I was using the name of Holmes because anyway, I used the name of Holmes, and I was in the recruitment center in Toronto. I'd left the show and had my understudy take over. And by that time, there was word out on me, and somebody shouted out, Ludlam? I said, yes, no, out. That was the end of my career in the RCAF. I did, however, the next year. I went back to school, and I did, however, the next year enlist in the Marines. I think it was on the day before my 17th birthday or something like that. I was in prep school and simply decided that, you know, everybody else was winning the war. Why can't I? And so I joined the Marines at 17.
Why did you want to get in the Marines? Because to win the war or to be in the action?
Yeah, I think so. I think at that age, you know, everything was so hyped up and, you know, we didn't like those other guys. I mean, we had a cause, a reason. And I just felt left out, and I wanted to get in as soon as possible. And And my mother was not terribly pleased with the idea, which is why I sort of did it surreptitiously. And I did send her a postcard from Paris Island, but
that's very nice.
I thought so. Yeah, a good son. Yeah.
So, did you see much action?
No. I don't go into that. I was in the South Pacific, but in such a minor way compared to other people. I don't even, you know, don't go into it. It's silly.
I guess I shouldn't assume that much of the action in your novels is based on your experience while in the Marines.
No, not that much. No, a certain amount of the hand-to-hand stuff. Yeah, but that's because I taught it for a while. I don't think I was very good at it, frankly. I think it was just because I'm 5'10½". I'm not one of the big guys, and they used to choose guys our size to teach that stuff because if a big guy went down, the other guys would get confidence. Boy, I still hurt thinking about that.
Robert Ludlum is my guest, and his new novel is called The Icarus Agenda. His other novels include The Osterman Weekend, The Aquitaine Progression, The Matteree Circle, and The Bourne Identity. We're going to talk some more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer Robert Ludlum is my guest. His new novel, titled The Icarus Agenda. Well, you mentioned before that you started your career as an actor, and I must say you really have a terrific voice. What kind of roles did you play when you were acting?
I either played homicidal killers or lawyers, and I've always thought there was a very definite connection. I was the guy that sent Siobhan McKenna to the stake in St. Joan. He was a lawyer, of course. And then the next show I did on television, I can't even remember the name of the show now, but I think I was considered schizophrenic, paranoid, dangerous, and I'm not sure I was electrocuted, but I certainly should have been. I think both for the acting and the role, but nevertheless, it was...
Now, you did commercial voiceovers for a while, too, right?
Yeah, I know. It's morally one step below theft, but when you have a couple of kids in college, it doesn't hurt. No.
What kind of commercials did you do the voicing for?
Well, let's see. You know, there's so many that you do, and there's so many that you try out for. You're never quite sure. I do know that I was the voice of Braniff Airlines. You remember, you'll like flying, Braniff style. And then, of course, there was the one years ago. I think I did it. I'm not sure, but should a gentleman offer a lady a Tipperillo? And then, of course, there was the plunge works fast. Let's not go into that. But no, it was thanks to a lovely agent. You know, people kept saying to me when I was an actor, boy, you'd make a terrific producer. And I got the message, you know, get off the stage. And so I did and became a producer. But when I did make the switch to, when I decided I really wanted to spend full time as a writer, to which my wife, who's a superb actress, she immediately thought she'd have to go back to work. She said, well, you're 40 years of age, Robert, and you might as well try it now, no matter how impoverished we may be. But I did have the voiceovers going, and I'm eternally grateful for it.
So you stuck with the voiceovers for a while to tide you over when you started writing?
Yeah, I did. But when my first book came out, I never again did them. In the first place, I wouldn't take a job from an actor. And secondly, an awful lot of actors, if I'd walk in and do for an audition, you know, I might be hung out the window, so I didn't do that anymore.
Did people used to recognize your voice?
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Well, it was embarrassing?
No, not embarrassing, but they'd say, don't I know you? And I'd say, I don't think so. Say, I'm sure I know you. And I knew what they were thinking of, you know. I had just sold Tuna Helper to them 45 times or something, you know. But or Hamburger Helper, whatever that was, I don't know.
So when you dropped acting at age 40, what made you think you could actually write?
Well, I've been writing. I've been a closet writer for years. When I was coming back from the South Pacific, I wrote a book that I'm afraid on discharge, myself and several friends over-imbibed at the Top of the Mark in San Francisco, and I lost an 800-page manuscript. And to this day, I say to people, they say, my God, you really lost a manuscript like that size? And I always say, yeah, you never remembered Naked and the Dead? I don't think Norman really appreciates that story, but it's true.
Why did you want to write international thrillers? Why did you start with that?
I didn't really start thinking I'm going to do that. And to this day, I don't label myself. I think I write suspense fiction. But then, so is the Iliad and the Odyssey. I think it probably comes from the theater. Suspense. If you don't want to know what happens in Act Two after Act One, your play's going to close and you're going to be on the unemployment line next Monday. And my unemployment number was 1344. I'll never forget it. So I think that idea of suspense comes from a theatrical background, from the theatrical experience.
Well, speaking of your theatrical experience, were you able to use acting in character development, since you knew about what it meant to get inside a character and how a character needed to be developed?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think so particularly, consciously. I think that's just part of where I come from. If you're going to try to get inside the head of somebody, I suppose you act it out in your imagination. I mean, I don't go around shouting Arabic or something like that, or Hebrew when I'm trying to describe something in the Middle East. But yeah, you try to get in the heads of people, and you try to use the only tool you've got, which is imagination.
Do you think that you write roles that you could play? Would you like to act the role of some of your main characters?
I think some of my actor friends would probably throw up at the thought, but nevertheless, I've been offered a number of roles since I became a writer, much more than I was ever offered as an actor. But no, I don't really think so. One, I couldn't take work from an actor. They work too hard for a living. But no, I don't have any great desire to act again, no.
Writer Robert Ludlum is my guest, his new book titled The Icarus Agenda. Well, I am hardly the first person to point out that just about every one of your books has a three-word title.
Yes.
The Bourne Supremacy, yes. The Aquitaine Progression, The Parsifal Mosaic, yeah. The Bourne Identity, The Matteri Circle, and on and on.
Yeah, well, I can tell you how it happened if you want to
know.
Yeah,
would you?
Yeah, the third or fourth book I wrote, the first book was Scarlatti Inheritance, the second, I think, was The Osterman Weekend, the third was Matlock Paper. Now, those were three-word titles because I felt they made sense. And I walked in with my fourth book, the publishers, and the title was Cable Tortugas. And here were these six people sitting around the table and looked at me like they were crying and weeping. And I said, my God, is it that bad? And they said, no, not the book. The book's all right, but the title. I said, what's wrong with the title? I mean, it says it. And they said, oh, no, you're identified with the three-word title. I said, what do you mean identified with I'm not identified with a popsicle, for heaven's sakes. Nobody knows who I am. They said, oh, no, and somebody in the New York Times had said I was identified. Well, if it was in the New York Times, that's where they got to believe it, And so I said, okay, fellas, now, wait a minute. I stop crying. I said, now, this whole book is about an exchange, right? I mean, diamonds for gyroscopes. And they said, yeah, an exchange. And I said, a guy who does it named Reinman, right? And they said, yes. And I said, how about the Reinman Exchange? Oh, thank you. And I thought, oh, my God, it's the silliest day I've ever spent in my life. But ever since then, they've wanted the three-word titles, and now it's become a game for me. I enjoy doing it, and I've seen people who've tried to, use three-word titles. And I think one of the funniest ones was the Massapequa Massacre that somebody put out. For me, the simplest with the meaning behind it. And I said to my agent once about 4 or 5 years ago, I said, what do you say I change a title and not a three-word title? And he began to cry. And I said, okay, forget it. I won't. I'll go three-word title. I mean, they pay me very well, and it's the least I can do for them.
But how did you first start writing three-word titles?
I don't know. It just seemed when I was writing about a guy named Scarlatti, and he was bankrolling the Nazi party from his inheritance, it seemed logical to me to call it the Scarlatti Inheritance. And when I was writing about a weekend of four couples, and where in the catalyst of it was a man named Osterman, it seemed quite logical to me to call it the Osterman Weekend. And the Matlock paper, there was a paper that could do all kinds of things. A piece of paper, the POP, that some critics write about, and I certainly didn't invent, neither did Conan Doyle. I think it goes back to the Phrygians or something, but I thought that, that's the paper that's going to explode everything. The guy, the protagonist was Matlock. Why not the Matlock paper? Then along came the Reinman Exchange, but actually the whole thing of the book was Cable Tortugas. This thing is going to blow apart. No, it didn't work. They wanted the Reinman Exchange. But no, it's never been a conscious thing. It wasn't then. It is now. Now I know that And I sympathize with them.
It's your duty to do it now.
Well, yeah, duty because they're nice people. And why not? And I think I'm a nice person, so we can compromise on this.
Didn't you write a couple of books under a pseudonym?
Yeah, I can talk about one of them, which is...
One of them you're not even revealing?
No, two of them I can't, because I think we're in court. I don't know, but something like that, they tell me. But one of them was The Road to Gandolfo, which was a pure farce comedy. And that was originally put out under the name of Michael Shepard, because I had a crazy shepherd dog then, and one of my son's names is Michael, and that's why I called it. Michael Shepard was the author.
Since your name sells so many books, why would you want to change it?
Because I wrote it, one, it was a farce comedy, far away from anything I'd done. I did it because a screenwriter friend of mine said, if you wrote a thriller about the kidnapping of the Pope, X said, I could do the screenplay and this and that. He's a great friend. And so I said to him, no, that can't be a thriller, you know, that you could do that in the 16th, 17th centuries, but not now. I mean, it just doesn't work. And so I persisted in my thought that it had to be a comedy, and he had tried it the other way, and it didn't work. And so he said, please, try it your way. And I began writing it, and frankly, it's just what I said in the preface when they released it under my own name. I began writing it, and I just had so much fun doing it. Because I love humor. I think one of the better things I ever did as an actor was comedy. And I just had such great fun doing it. And that's how it happened. There's nothing mystical about it. I just enjoy comedy.
Now, the two books that you can't really talk about, can you talk about why you wrote those under a pseudonym? Or is that part of what you're not allowed to discuss?
I think it's part of what I'm not supposed to discuss.
Fair enough. Right. Now, your book, The Osterman Weekend, is, I think, the only one of your books so far that was made into a movie. Is that right?
No. There was another one. If it was just The Osterman Weekend, I think I might stop writing. But
you didn't like the movie, huh?
Well, let's put it this way. Nobody tries. You know, a writer can always say no to movies. The reason we don't say no is that we're greedy. And so, therefore, you know, we can't sit back and cry. But when they sent me the work print of that, one, I do not write pornography. And they opened with a graphically pornographic scene. And then they sent me a work print. That's how I happened to see it, from the Coast, because they wanted me to do some television and radio interviews with the director. And after 20 minutes, I picked up the phone and booked passage to Hong Kong so I wouldn't be here when it opened. It was and of course, that book is simply a shaggy dog story, a one-act tale that if all these four couples had communicated, nothing would have happened. So what did they do in the movie? They blew up half the couples in halfway through, which of course means they didn't quite understand the book, and nobody bothered to call me. And I never saw the screenplay. And but no, there was another one made, Holcroft Covenant, with Michael Caine. And I actually think that's not bad at all. I think that's that captures a lot of a very, very complicated book. And Michael Caine is marvelous in it.
Yeah, yeah. We only have a couple of seconds left, but
surely.
Would you like to see more movies made from your books?
Well, I think really I fall into the category of miniseries. There's one that's been... No, really, I mean that.
Well, the books are long enough, that's for
sure.
Yeah,
that's what I mean. They've just finished doing The Bourne Identity with Richard Chamberlain and Jacqueline Smith. They just finished filming in Geneva last week, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, and there are others in the works now.
Okay, well, listen, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been writer Robert Ludlum. His new thriller is titled The Icarus Agenda. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Peter Shirofsky. He's the author of the new book, Born Guilty. It's about the children of Nazi families in Germany. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. ¶¶
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Cassandra Wilson didn't plan to be a performer when she moved to the New York area, but she ended up being hailed as one of the best new jazz vocalists around. Coming up, Cassandra Wilson tells how it happened. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Now and Zen. It's the fourth album from singer Robert Plant since he left the supergroup Led Zeppelin. And film critic Stephen Schiff offers an appreciation of Divine, the man who is best known as the leading lady in the movies of John Waters. Divine died earlier this week at the age of 42. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. The Republican presidential field narrowed today as New York Congressman Jack Kemp dropped out of the race. Kemp did not endorse any other candidate, though he said he might later on. And Kemp also announced that he's retiring from the House after 18 years in office. NPR's Jim Angle reports.
Kemp, who sought to be the conservative alternative in the Republican race, said today he fought the good fight, but that it was time to accept defeat so he could move on to fight again.
Today, I'm withdrawing from the race for president. I'm folding up my tent, but I want you to know I'm going to continue to carry the flag high now and in the future.
As his supporters chanted Kemp in 92, he made clear that he has every intention of running for the presidency again. When asked what went wrong this time, Kemp said it was his first campaign and noted that Ronald Reagan had to run three times before he was elected. But Kemp said many of the ideas he championed, such as tax cuts, had been adopted by Ronald Reagan and have now been embraced by all the Republican candidates. And he proclaimed that there are no more liberals in the Republican Party. But with everyone in the Republican race running as a conservative, Kemp was unable to draw the support he needed against better-known candidates such as Bush and Dole. I'm Jim Angle in Washington.
Campaign aides to Robert Dole denied rumors today that the Senate minority leader is about to end his presidential bid. The rumors began after the Dole campaign pulled $500,000 in television ads, which were to have aired in Illinois. More than half of Dole's Illinois campaign staff has been laid off as well. But Dole spokeswoman Dale Tate said, "We're not pulling the plug on the campaign." She said the ads were pulled to give the campaign time to reassess its television plans in Illinois, the site of the next presidential primary. And according to the Associated Press, Gary Hart will call an end to his presidential campaign. The one-time Democratic frontrunner has called a news conference for tomorrow in Denver. Since re-entering the race in December with a pledge to let the people decide, Hart has won no delegates to the Democratic National Convention. The foiled hijacking of a Soviet airliner on Tuesday turns out to have been a desperate attempt by an 11-member Siberian family that wanted to escape to the West. Nine people, including five of the family members, died when Soviet troops stormed the plane at an airport outside Leningrad. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
Widow Ninel Ovyechkin left her home in the central Siberian city of Irkutsk on Tuesday and boarded a Leningrad-bound flight with her 10 children. Seven of her sons played in a local jazz ensemble, and they used their musical instrument cases to conceal sawed-off rifles that were pulled out when they demanded that the plane be flown to London. Their attempt was thwarted when the plane's crew landed at a military airport outside Leningrad. The crew had told the hijackers they were landing in Finland to refuel. A dramatic account published in the government newspaper Izvestia today said that in the ensuing battle, Mrs. Ovyechkin's sons killed their mother and a female flight attendant. The newspaper quoted eyewitnesses as saying that two of the sons then committed suicide. Three passengers and two other members of the Ovyechkin family were also killed. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
The Pentagon says Bell Helicopter has agreed to pay the Army $88 million to settle the Army's claim that the company overcharged the military for parts over a three-year period. It's one of the largest settlements ever in a defense contracting case. A judge today barred Texas Air Corporation from selling Eastern Airlines' highly profitable air shuttle business. Unions at Eastern opposed the $225 million sale to a Texas Air subsidiary, saying it was part of an anti-labor campaign. U.S. District Court Judge John Pratt held Texas Air in contempt of court for violating a 1987 order which blocked the airline holding company from moving Eastern employees to a subsidiary. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 48 points to close at 2026.03. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of a new album from singer Robert Plant called Now and Zen. The title belies Plant's heavy metal past with Led Zeppelin, the group that more or less invented metal. Many bands have imitated Plant's Led Zeppelin style. But after other ventures, Ken says Plant has dug back to his roots.
2 decades ago, Robert Plant did nothing less than invent a new style of rock singing on the records he made as part of the English band Led Zeppelin. Using black blues singers like Howlin' Wolf and white pop singers like Johnny Ray as his models, Plant bellowed out songs like Stairway to Heaven and Whole Lotta Love and created classic rock music unlike anything that had preceded it. Led Zeppelin broke up in 1980, soon after the death of the band's equally original drummer, John Bonham. Since then, Robert Plant has released 4 solo albums. That's Billy's Revenge, one of Robert Plant's new songs, and its blunt concision is something new for him. What makes this album worthwhile is that it's the first of Plant's solo albums that does something besides echo his Led Zeppelin days. Like many influential pop performers, Plant did his most innovative work early on in his career, and has spent the latter part of it reproducing those same effects. His first hit as a solo act a couple of years ago was a misguided phallic symbol called Big Log that sounded like a Monty Python parody of Led Zeppelin. Plant's new album doesn't always avoid this sort of thing either.
And I don't care if I die.
That's Dance on My Own, the closest Plant comes to self-parody on Now and Zen. He sounds like the humorless shouters who've been imitating his keening tenor for years now. In fact, it's these imitators who may have provoked the good music to be found on Now and Zen. In a recent spate of interviews he's given to promote the album, Plant invariably mentions how much he hates the way David Coverdale, lead singer of Whitesnake, seems to be doing little more than a Robert Plant impersonation. Plant has taken to referring to him as David Coverversion. What probably riles Plant the most is that the latest Whitesnake album sold over 5 million copies. Such jealousy is a powerful inspiration. In retaliation, Plant has written an amazing song, White, Clean, and Neat, a varied, detailed piece of autobiography that brings the album to a cool climax.
Now and Zen can't reasonably be compared to the best music Plant recorded with Led Zeppelin. It inevitably lacks the surprise and force and overweening ambition of that early music. But Plant's new record works on at least two levels, as excellent nostalgia disguised as new product, and as desperation that has yielded good art.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's some more Robert Plant from Now and Zen. Fresh air. Cassandra Wilson is a jazz singer who's trying to find her place in contemporary music. She's been influenced by such contemporary jazz singers as Sarah Vaughan, Abby Lincoln, and Betty Carter, but she's not strictly following in that tradition. Her singing is spiced with funk. She's recorded two albums in the last few years since she moved up to New York from her home in Mississippi. On each of the albums, she's either written or arranged about half of the music. Here she is singing Electro Magnolia, which she co-wrote with trumpeter Olu Dara. It's from her album Days Away.
I fell in love with you. Neither the old magnolia tree. When a firefly blew past your eyes, I said, I'm gonna catch it, put it in a jar.
How were you first noticed?
I sat in at a club that used to be on Broadway called the Jazz Forum. And that used to be a place where young musicians would go to sit in, you know, when they came to town. It's like the place people tell you, you know, when you come into town, if you want to sit in or if you want to get into some music, meet some musicians, go to the Jazz Forum. And there I met a great pianist, Sadiq Hakim, who's no longer with us. And he sort of took me under his wing, and he really liked me, and introduced me to a lot of musicians, and actually got me my first gig.
As you started getting more serious about singing and singing professionally, what are some of the things you wanted to learn and some of the things you wanted to change in your own style as you got deeper and deeper into it?
For a while, I did want to become more technically accurate, you know, in terms of my voice. I always felt that that was like a weakness that I had, not actually singing chords, you know, actually singing changes. If you notice, when a lot of singers improvise, they tend to deal within a very simple universe, you know, when it comes to improvising. And that's one thing I always wanted to work on, and I still work on to this day, learning actual changes, you know, singing changes, and hearing more complicated types of intervals.
You sing some standards, but not many, at least not on your albums. Are you trying to like sing some, but to emphasize original material?
Yes, I'm heading in that direction. I would like to get to the point where I do all original material. I enjoy doing standards, though. I really get a lot of fun out of it and enjoyment out of it. So, you know, there are people who tell you, well, if you do standards, then you should do all standards. And there are people who tell you that if you do original music, you should do all original music. And I just pretty much paid attention to my intuition in terms of that. And everything that the standards that I choose, I think, fit inside of, you know, the whole body of work that I do.
You sing Let's Face the Music and Dance on your latest album.
Mm-hmm.
How did you arrange that yourself? How did you decide to interpret that song? That is one of the songs that many great singers have sung before.
Mm-hmm. Actually, Henry Threadgill suggested that tune. He suggested that tune to me, and I was shocked that he suggested it, because Henry's not really the type of musician who gets into the standard repertoire, but he really liked that song. Everything just kind of happened, you know, in terms of the arrangement. We got into a rehearsal with it, and I heard it very up, you know, and very bright, and finally heard it, like, with a trumpet solo out front, and that's the way it happened.
Trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Before the fiddlers have fled, before they ask us to pay the bill, and while we still have the chance, let's face the music and dance. Oh, soon we'll be without the moon, humming a different tune, and then maybe teardrops to shed. But while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance.
I want to ask you about another piece on your latest album. And the piece is called Apricots on Their Wings.
Mm-hmm.
It was composed by Henry Threadgill.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about the origins of this song?
I really don't know what the...
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Well, Henry told me that it was... I never understood the lyrics. I mean, and I just had to one day I came out and asked him, I said, you know, what does this mean? And he said, well, it's kind of a nonsensical type of a lyrical thing. You know, the words sounded pleasant to him, and they worked well together lyrically. So he put them together.
Well, how important is it as a singer to really understand and even relate to the lyrics that you're singing?
Well, it depends on the material. For something like Apricots, I just got a lot of joy out of the melody of that tune and just the way it moves. So it was always just, I somehow intuitively could feel what it meant, and, you know, just from dealing with the sound of it.
Do some nice scatting on the beginning of that piece. Now, was that improvised or was that composed beforehand?
No, it was completely improvised.
Do you like scatting?
Oh, yeah, I enjoy it very much. In fact, I don't really call it scatting. I think that scatting is like that's taken from a bebop era where vocalists tended to try to imitate horns But what I do, I really don't try to imitate horns. I just improvise and create sounds that are distinctive to the voice. And sometimes it just so happens that they do sound like instruments, but that's like not the initial approach, you know, to sound like an instrument. I like the idea of being a voice.
You said before that some people tell you to just sing standards or to sing no standards.
Right. Everybody's got an opinion, you know. It's like, oh, you should do this. And
have your musician friends discouraged you from singing standards?
Yes.
In a word. Some musicians really think of singers as just being pretty props to put in front of musicians, and they don't really respect them that much. I don't know. You know, and that's why I think standards get that kind of reputation, because they're associated with the things that singers do.
Mm-hmm.
Have you found that kind of stuff to be true?
Yeah, I think there's a suspicion
of singers and standards.
Mm-hmm. I think the distrust of singers comes from something that it's based on something that historically is true. Singers tended to move into the music without very much of a depth of knowledge in music theory. And so I think as a result of that, musicians just tend to like disrespect singers, because sometimes when they get up there, they don't know, you know, a lot of the time they don't know what they're doing. They're not really functioning as musicians inside the group. They're functioning as simply singers.
And do you want to function as a musician inside the group? Is that?
Oh, I do function mm-hmm. as a musician inside my group, inside of any context that I am, because basically that's what I am, a musician who sings.
Cassandra Wilson's new album, Days Away, is on the JMT label. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, we're following this airliner hijacking in the Soviet Union. A plane was taken over briefly by a family that also is a jazz group. And we report on what happened there. Also on some political developments in Poland and Czechoslovakia, both countries that have big 20th anniversaries to mark in this season. Also, did you hear that Jack Kemp folded his presidential campaign today?
I knew he was dropping out.
Well, he did, actually. And that leaves the presidential race down to Bob Dole, George Bush, of course, who may have just about sewn it up, and Pat Robertson.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The actor Divine died earlier this week at the age of 42, and to his fans it was like losing both a favorite actress and actor, because Divine was so entertaining playing either sex. He first became famous in John Waters' film Pink Flamingos. The 300-pound actor played the filthiest woman alive.
Let this be a lesson to you, just in case there is reincarnation. It's virtually impossible to be filthier than Divine. I didn't get my reputation for nothing, you know. But you found out too late, Connie. Yeah, it's too late. Now you're not going to be around to put your newfound knowledge to use. Because you're going to be dead, Connie. Dead! Yes, dead!
Later, John Waters brought out a different side of Divine's acting. In Polyester, Divine starred as a beleaguered housewife and mother.
Dexter's been expelled from school.
For what?
For truancy.
It's just those common Baltimore public schools. God, I wished I lived in Connecticut.
The principal said that he was insane.
He's probably out playing polo with his friends.
Oh, Cuddles, do you think there is something wrong with my son?
In their last collaboration, Hairspray, Waters directed Divine in two roles, a doting mother and a racist male TV station owner. Film critic Stephen Schiff remembers Divine.
Everyone who went to high school in America knew someone like him. The weird kid, really weird. The one who was so unfathomably different that you couldn't take your eyes off him in the cafeteria. He was the kind of kid whom the class bullies would never tire of beating up after school, just because his very presence seemed some nameless provocation. The psychic scars such teenagers suffer are hard to measure. They might have marred fat, effeminate Glenn Milstead of Baltimore for life, if it weren't for a crazy kid up the street named John Waters. For Waters, Glenn was a mesmerizing presence. As he told one interviewer, "My father used to drive us to school, and we'd see this creature with dyed red hair. My father would just shudder. I figured anyone who could get that reaction just by standing there, I had to know." Eventually, Waters met Glenn Milstead, dressed him up in drag and heavy makeup, and cast him in some of his Cheap Jack movies. Oh, and changed his name to Divine. It's a kindness that if death was stalking Divine, it at least waited until now to claim him. It waited until the former butt of his classmates' jokes had finally made a mainstream hit movie, John Waters' new film Hairspray. It waited until he'd made the cover of Interview magazine and met people like Elizabeth Taylor and Jack Nicholson. Divine thought of himself as a character actor, not as a transvestite. At the end of his life, he'd begun playing men's roles, and he was appealing in them. But as a man, he would probably never have had the impact that he had in Pink Flamingos as Babs Johnson, the filthiest person in the world, or as the incorrigible immoralist Dawn Davenport in Female Trouble, which is still among the most brilliant and scabrous meditations on American crime the movies have ever produced. Divine was never a terrific actor. Part of the campy pleasure one derived from his performances lay in their undisguised amateurishness. He always looked as though he were trying too hard, going all out to escape his all-too-visible limitations, his weight, his talent. But what he lacked in technique, he more than made up for in verve and presence, and in courage. Everything Divine did on screen went fervently and energetically against the prevailing grain. He was truly a rebel without a cause, or with no cause more clearly defined than a kind of generalized up yours. And yet, there was never anything sullen or self-important about Divine's insurgency. For him, flying in the face of convention and good taste was simply more fun than towing the line. Every time he performed, you could see him shaking off the burden of those high school humiliations, and of every other humiliation he'd ever suffered. For him, acting was liberation. I hope that by the time he died, he knew how much watching him had liberated us.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair magazine. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I'll talk with rapper Kool Moe Dee about his new album, How You Like Me Now. He thinks he has the best rhymes and rhythms in rap music, and a lot of listeners agree. Also, white African folk singer Tony Bird will be featured in our weekly performance spot, and critic Ken Tucker will check out some new home videos, including Penn and Teller's Cruel Tricks for Dear Friends, a collection of the magical duo's favorite scams. So I hope you can join us. And we'd love to hear from you. Drop us a line at Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers today are Ed Doherty, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon and Lisa Bruton directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.